It's my favorite part. Always makes me wonder, you know, maybe it was better to have drank and lost than never to have drank at all, huh? It's nice to be back at the Altoona Roundup. Right now, let's thank the committee. Let's thank the people that worked all year so we had some place to be tonight, huh? Let's give them a round of applause. I want to thank Don for picking me up at the airport. It's always an adventure. You never know who's going to pick you up. You know, I go to a lot of airports, and if you've been to airports, you know. You walk into baggage, and almost always you go down the escalator, and there's two or three guys standing there at the end of the escalator, got black suits on, and they little hand-printed signs. I flew into Charlotte a couple years ago, and walked down the escalator, and sure enough, there's three guys with their little black suits on and hand-printed signs. And there's a guy standing next to him. He's got a pair of shorts on, a Hawaiian shirt, and a piece of cardboard doesn't say anything on it. So I knew who was there for me. And I go to a lot of roundups. I always wondered why y'all call them roundups. You ever wonder that? I did. So I looked it up. And in dictionary, it says this. Roundup. A systematic gathering up, as in suspects by the police. Now, I'm pretty sure what I'm going to say up here tonight. But I'm not pretty sure what you're going to hear, huh? There's a little story I like to tell. It's a story about a state trooper. And this state trooper, he's just sitting on the side of the road waiting for somebody to go by doing something wrong. And that's what state troopers do. Sure enough, on that day, a boy came driving by in a pickup truck. The back of that pickup truck was full of penguins. And that state trooper, he picked right up on that. He pulled that boy over. He says, son, where are you going with all those penguins in the back of that pickup truck? He said, well, officer, we're not going anywhere. We're just out for a ride. He said, boy, what's wrong with you? You can't take penguins for a ride. You take those penguins to the zoo. And he said, yes, sir, I will. Next morning, that trooper's in the same spot, and here come that boy in that pickup truck one more time. Back of that truck still full of penguins. But on that day, all those penguins got sunglasses on. He pulled them over again. He said, boy, I thought I told you to take those penguins to the zoo. He said, well, yes, sir, I did. Today we're going to the beach. Now, we all kind of see and hear things differently, don't we? No, really, you can be looking at the same thing I'm looking at, listening to the same person I'm listening to, but you're going to see something different, and you're going to hear something different than me. Let me give you an example. There's a room. In the middle of the room, there's a table. Sitting in the middle of that table is a $100 bill. Now, standing around that table is the perfect man, the perfect woman, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny. And the lights went out. When the lights went back on, that $100 bill was gone. Now, who do you think took it? Well, no, it had to be the woman. We all know it had to be the woman because those other three things don't exist. My name's Tim Towsley. I'm an alcoholic. Man, I did not want to be an alcoholic. I planned not to be an alcoholic. My daddy was an alcoholic. He was a member of this fellowship. He got sober in 1946. He passed away in 1980. He had 10 years of continuous sobriety put together at that time in his life. And what that did for me early in my life, it gave me an opportunity to see what an alcoholic was all about, see what alcoholism was all about, and also to see what Alcoholics Anonymous was all about. I came from a family where I had 6 stepfathers. I had 13 stepmothers. I went to over 20 schools. I never got out of the 8th grade. Been married 3 times and divorced 2 times. I left home when I was 14 years old. I've had an opportunity in my life to spend time in boys' homes, detention homes, city jails, county jails, workhouses, psych wards, treatment centers, and penitentiaries. I spent 12 years of my adult life either on parole, probation, or locked behind some kind of door somewhere. And do you know not one of those things I just mentioned are the reasons I came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous? Those were merely the situations my disease of alcoholism created in my life. But on June 23rd, 1982, I woke up at the bottom. And it's the bottom they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a loneliness. It's when you know a loneliness such as few men know. It's when you're at that jumping off place. You're wishing for the end. You can no longer imagine life with or life without alcohol. And that's the bottom. Now, that's not a high bottom. But you know it's not a low bottom either. You see, it's just my bottom. And that is the only bottom I ever need to concern myself with in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is my bottom. I don't ever want to be in a position in my sobriety where I can sit in a room of alcoholics, I can listen to a speaker speak, and I can start thinking things like, you know, maybe I wasn't that bad, huh? Or maybe I was worse. As soon as I can sit out there and I can make myself believe I'm different in any way from anybody else that's sitting in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, as soon as I can make myself believe I'm unique in any way from anybody else in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, then I've got reservations. And there was an old timer in Berea, Ohio, where I got sober, told me all the time. He said, Tim, if you got reservations, son, you must be going somewhere, huh? And I don't want to go anywhere today. I like it here. One thing I know for sure today is God wants me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my first drink at 13. I got sick. I blacked out. I passed out. I woke up in the backyard of a lady's house in Rocky River, Ohio. I had my last drink at 30. And I got sick. I blacked out. And I passed out. And I woke up at home in bed. 17 years of use and abuse. The only real difference was where I woke up the next day. Most of the days were pretty much the same. But this I know for sure, that God wants me here. There was a woman found me in her backyard. She took me in her house. She cleaned me up. She found out who I was. She called my mom and let my mom know I was okay. 17 years later, I came through that door. I went to a meeting. I was about 2 weeks sober. And that woman was speaking at the meeting. My very first drunk. I found myself in the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she did for me that night all she knew how to do. She was sober about 60 days when she found me in her backyard. And what they told her to do at her home group was help a drunk. And that's what she did. They didn't tell her only help the old drunks or the young drunks. The male drunks or the female drunks, the black drunks or the white drunks, they told her to help a drunk, period. And that's what she did that night. And do you know, I still see that woman at meetings today. She's over 80 years old and over 40 years sober, and she's still helping drunks. Now, there's two things I ran from most of my life. I'm not crazy about them today. I got a lot of them today. I got much, much more of them today than I ever wanted in my whole life. But I don't run from them today. I deal with them. And those two things are responsibility and authority. You know, I don't like being responsible. There's a lot of responsibility involved with being responsible, you know. And I certainly don't like people telling me I'm supposed to be responsible. It seemed like at my age, at 13 or 14 years old, everybody had an idea about Tim's life. How long his hair should be, how high the heels on his boots should be, go to school, don't go to school, come home, don't come home. Everybody had an idea. No one asked me. I'm at a family gathering when I was 14 years old. I'm listening to people talk, and I heard somebody say this. They said, my daddy, my real father, was in New Orleans, and he was sober. And with that information, I left home the next day. Because I knew what my problem was. See, it wasn't what I was doing or who I was doing it with. My problem was I didn't have my real father in my life. And if I could get my real father in my life, everything would be okay. I got to New Orleans. I contacted Alcoholics Anonymous. They found my daddy for me, and they put us together. And all of a sudden, I had a father, and he had a son. We tried to be those two things, but we'd just never been either. Neither one of us ever been either of those two things before. We didn't know what he was doing. We did the best we could. I'd never been a son before. He'd never been daddy before. And it just didn't work out. After about 30 days, I learned something. You see, my daddy started drinking again. And I can remember falling into my mother's living room, drunk, passing out in her living room, and the next morning having her scream at me saying, "Son, don't drink. Please don't drink. You'll get what your father has." But I never saw what he had that she was trying to keep me from getting until I watched him drink in New Orleans. I watched him get drunk. I watched him go into the DTs, and I watched the people from Alcoholics Anonymous come into our little house, take him away, and put him in Bridge House in New Orleans. And I made a decision on that day. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. I'm not going to end up like my daddy ended up. And I didn't have another drink for the next 4 years. I really didn't do much anything for the next 4 years. I just hitchhiked all around this country. Because all of a sudden, there I was. I was in a city in New Orleans. I've got no authority. I've got no responsibility. I've got the rest of my life to do with whatever I think I want to do with it, and it's 1966. And I guess I was a hippie. At least that's what folks called me. But I had 4 good years. My expectations were met. If I had a pack of cigarettes, something to eat, and a sleeping bag, it was a good day. That's all I needed out of life. It was a pack of cigarettes, a sleeping bag, and something to eat, and it was a good day. My expectations were met. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me this, that my expectations are inversely proportional to my serenity level. And I don't know about you. I know a little bit about me today. Let me tell you about me. Do you know if I get exactly, now I mean exactly, what I think I'm supposed to have, exactly, when I think I'm supposed to have it, I'm a pretty happy guy. But as soon as I don't, my serenity level isn't met. My serenity level drops because my expectations aren't met. I'm 18 years old and I don't want to play anymore. All of a sudden, I don't want to do what I'm doing anymore. I want to come home. I want some American dream. I want some of the stuff from the billboards. You know the billboards that tell you if you drive this kind of car, you're okay? If you wear those kind of clothes, you're okay. And if you live in that kind of neighborhood, then you're okay. All of a sudden at 18, I want to be okay. And me and a friend of mine left Berkeley, California, and we started hitchhiking east because I'm going home. We got dropped off in the middle of the mountains in the middle of Utah. I don't know where we were to this day. This was a road that went up into the mountains in the middle of Utah. There was no houses, no convenience stores, no gas stations, no nothing, just a road. And that's where we got dropped off. We slept there that night, woke up, froze to death. Walked down to the bottom of the on-ramp, sitting at the bottom of that on-ramp at about 7 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of Utah, in the middle of nowhere, sits all by itself a six-pack of Olympia beer. Man, I know God wants me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank 3 beers. He drank 3 beers. I looked at him. I said, "You know, if I go back to Cleveland alive, I'm settling down. I'm going to marry the first girl I see." Well, that's all. You got to have the girl. That's all part of the American dream, to be okay. I got back to Cleveland. My stepfather wasn't home, so I was allowed in the house. I changed my clothes. I took a shower. I borrowed my mother's car. I drove to the corner to get a pack of cigarettes, picked a young lady up hitchhiking, and we got married. We got married that day. But, you know, we might have. But back then in the state of Ohio, the male had to be 21 who had parental consent, and the female had to be 18 who had parental consent. And when I married my first wife, I was 18 and she was 15. This was not a marriage that was made in heaven. We didn't know anything about being married. We really didn't know anything about anything. We didn't know about being in love. I can't tell you to this day if I loved her. I can tell you this, though. I live in my brother's van in the driveway of my parents' home, because I haven't been allowed in their house since I'm 14 years old. She lives wherever she can because there's things going on in her house she just doesn't want to go back to. And that brought us together, see. We weren't alone anymore. And that was enough at that time, just not to be alone. And it was a simple marriage. I got up in the morning, I got drunk. She got up in the morning, she got drunk. And then we'd beat each other up. Now, we did that one day at a time for about 7 years. But out of that 7 years, I was away a lot. I travel a lot. I travel a lot then. I travel a lot now. I just travel. But this little part of my life was kind of different. It was different, traveling. I'd walk into a room kind of like this. There'd be a man sitting in the front. And he'd have a long black coat on. Every time he did this, I went somewhere. I was just always in trouble. I had a bad attitude. I'm a child of the 60s. I was always in trouble. I got a report card home from the third grade. Y'all remember your report cards? You'd have to take it home. Your teacher would snitch on you on the back of it. You'd have to give it to your mama. My third grade report card says this. It says bad attitude. It says Timothy does not play well with others, it says. I'm 8 years old. I haven't had a drink yet, but they know I got a problem. Now, I wasn't a violent criminal. I was a stupid criminal. I got arrested for stupid stuff. I got arrested for stuff like verbal abuse of a police officer. That was in a little city called Parma, Ohio. I got arrested for obscene finger language to a police officer. And that was in Parma, Ohio. And if y'all don't know nothing about Parma, Ohio, I want to tell you this. They got no sense of humor, man, in Parma, Ohio. I was at a meeting one night. I was about 2 years sober. I don't know about anybody else. 2 years sober, I was pretty close to the smartest person in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 2 years sober. When I got to a meeting, I made sure y'all knew just how much I did know about Alcoholics Anonymous, too. But do you ever go to a meeting and you hear somebody talk and they say something? You know you've heard that person say that exact same thing 100 times, right? But now, all of a sudden, it makes sense. There was an old-timer at the meeting that night, and he was a good friend of mine. He's passed away, and I miss him. He was one of those guys, and I know you got one. You got one. That when you get to the meeting, if you see them in the room, you just know it's going to be okay. No matter how you feel when you get there, he doesn't even have to know you're there. You don't have to talk to him. But if you see him in the room, you know it's going to be okay. And Vic stood up here that night, and he talked, and I know I'd heard Vic talk 50 times. And Vic said this. He said, I've been arrested 63 times. I wasn't a good criminal. Man, I picked right up on that. I know I've been charged with 63 crimes. I wasn't a good criminal. People that do what I do and got caught as often as I got caught weren't real good at what they're doing. I learned something else in that verbal abuse case of a police officer. You see, I decided to represent myself in that case. What's so funny? I know I saw enough Perry Mason Judd for the defense, you know. No, I can do this. I went to court. I called witnesses, cross-examined witnesses, gave my final arguments to the judge. Y'all know what I found out, right? I'm not a very good attorney either. It's just the way my life was going. 1975, I stood in front of a judge on the old Lakeside Courthouse in downtown Cleveland, and he sentenced me to 20 to 40 years in the penitentiary. And I took a big sigh of relief on that day. I felt good on that day. You see, I felt better than I had in a long time. I can hear my wife and my mother in the back of the courtroom. They're crying. They don't think I should go away, and they don't want me to go for that long. But they don't know what I know. I know something on that day. You see, I know they can't send me anywhere that's going to hurt me as much as I've already hurt me. And that judge has no idea. There's no way on earth for him to punish me any more than I've already punished myself. And I know it on that day. And I'm ready to go anywhere where I might have a better chance against myself. Now, in 1976, the Ohio law has changed. My sentence went from a 20 to 40 to a 1 to 10. And 3 years later, they sent me home. But when I got home, all my stuff was gone. All the stuff I had to have was gone. The stuff to fit into your world so you could look at me and say, hey, you're okay, was gone. My wife was gone. My car was gone. My motorcycle was gone. My clothes and my jewelry were gone. There was nothing left. And I didn't do anything for the next 30 or 40 days but drink. I crawled into a vial of alcohol. I got as drunk as I could, blacked out as I could, passed out as I could. As many times that day as I needed to, I crawled into that bottle of alcohol. Not once in my life have I ever crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from you. Never have I crawled into a bottle of alcohol to hide from them. I got as drunk as I could, blacked out as I could, passed out as I could, as many times that day as I needed to. I crawled into that bottle to hide from me. You see, I knew what I was. I was an ex-con. I was an ex-husband. I was an ex-brother, and I was an ex-son. I failed at everything I ever tried to do. But if I was drunk enough, I didn't have to look. Finally, a friend of mine came over, almost physically took me out of my home. I'm not going to let you sit here and drink yourself to death. You're out of prison. It's time to start living again. And he took me down to a part of Cleveland we call the Flats. This is a long time ago. This is before they ruined the Flats. They yuppied it all up, you know? The Flats really, it was just a great place to go get drunk. That's what you did in the Flats. You drank stuff like Pabst Blue Ribbon beer and Jim Beam bourbon, and you got drunk. You didn't go to the Flats to have dinner. You didn't go to the Flats on your boat. You certainly never went to the Flats to buy something that came from something called the microbrewery. We walked into a little bar called the Pirate's Cove that night. My cousin's band was playing. They're playing a Marshall Tucker song. I'm about half in the bag. I'm drinking past Blue Ribbon beer, and this pretty little girl walked past me, and she smiled at me. You know, I smiled right back. That was her. That was my future ex-wife. Who shall heretofore be known as the plaintiff. That's who that was. Let me tell you about my second wife, because when she came to my house, she had some stuff with her. I think I had this stuff, I just don't know where it went. She brought things with her. She brought things like love with her. She brought honesty. She brought unselfishness, and she brought purity. These are the things she had with her when she came. And 7 years, or 4 years later, she left. And the only thing she had left to take was the disease of alcoholism. It stripped every decent thing that woman had. I'm not the only one I hurt when I pick up a drink, and I know that today. I touch a lot of lives. I tried for a couple of years to do the right thing. Went to work every day, never called in sick, was never late. I tried to do the right thing like everybody else in the world had been doing. And after 2 years, I'm sitting in my house drunk, and I'm surveying my dynasty, huh? After 2 years, do you know I don't have a house on the lake? I don't have a Porsche in the driveway. I'm not wearing the right kind of clothes, and I certainly don't run around with the right kind of people after 2 years. I came to a conclusion that night that those things are for other people. And no matter what I did, I'm just one of the people that's not supposed to have them. I woke up the next morning, called my boss, and quit my job. Just wasn't no reason to work that hard if I was never going to have them things anyway. My wife lasted for another 2 years, and she had to go. And the end of my drinking's not too exciting. I got up, I got drunk. If I got up again, I got drunk again. You know those family gatherings we have? Maybe it's Thanksgiving, Christmas, Mother's Day, whatever it is. We're all going to go somewhere, huh? We'll sit around a table, we'll hold hands, and we'll say grace. We'll share a meal with each other. When we're done eating, we're going to hang out. And we'll share what's going on in each other's lives. This is the way it works at my house. I pull into my parents' driveway, and I blow the horn. When they hear the horn inside, my little brother will come out of the back door. He'll have a paper plate in his hand, and it'll be wrapped in tinfoil. And he'll hand me my holiday meal. And I can sit in my car and eat my holiday meal off a paper plate with a plastic knife and a plastic fork. I can't sit at their table and say grace. They certainly don't want me to share anything with them that's going on in my life at that time. But I don't want you to think they stopped loving me. Not even this much. My parents realized that every time they reached down and stopped me from hitting my bottom, Every time they allowed me not to be responsible for my own actions, they were killing me. You see, my parents loved me so much, they let me go. I don't have any children. I can only imagine how much love that must take, huh? June 23rd, 1982, I woke up at that bottom I told you about, and I didn't know what to do. When I didn't know what to do in my life, I always did the same thing. I made a phone call. I don't know if I made that phone call 100 times or 1,000 times. The same phone call. It was, Mom, help. And my mom came. I couldn't go to her. She would always come to me. She walked into my little house. I'm kneeling on the living room floor. I'm shaking apart. I'm crying uncontrollably. I have hepatitis, and I weigh 112 pounds. And the first words out of my mother's mouth were, I'll kill her for doing this to you. Alcoholism. This is a family disease. Blaming others is a big part of this disease, and my mother has it too. We made some phone calls, and I found myself in an emergency room. I got a doctor playing with my liver. He says, son, you got an alcohol problem. I said, no. No, not me. No. And we're arguing back and forth. I'm ready to be anything else he wants me to be. Pick one. But don't pick that one, you know? He says, son, I don't care what you think you want to be or don't want to be. If you don't quit drinking, you're going to die. And I heard him say that. I spent the next 10 days in a psych ward on the east side of Cleveland. First three in restraints. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. Now, that sounded just a little bit like step one, didn't it? A little bit. I got a psychiatrist in my psych ward. I got the happiest psychiatrist on earth in my psych ward. And he comes to visit me every morning about 7 o'clock in the morning. Jim, how you doing? Good to see you. Isn't it a marvelous day, huh? I don't know about the rest of y'all. 7 o'clock in the morning in a psych ward? On the east side of Cleveland? Tied to the bed? I'm not real spiritual. I'm just not. And then he just did what psychiatrists do. Y'all know what they do, right? They write in their charts. They nod their heads. That's what they do. Pretty soon they make you take that test, don't they? Did you ever take that test? Man, I'd have a nickel for every time I took that test. The MMPI test? Got 600 questions on it. There's only one question on that test I can't answer. It's my favorite question on the whole MMPI test. It says, do you urinate more than most people? I don't know. On the third day, he came into my room. I don't want to forget this day. He sat on the edge of my bed. He undid the straps. He said, Tim, I can't make your wife come home. I don't have a job to give you. I'm not going to make a house payment for you. But if you never want to take another drink as long as you live, I can tell you how to do that one day at a time. This psychiatrist was a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that God wants me here. He shared a little bit of his story with me. Then I shared a little bit of my story with him. And all of a sudden, it was no longer I'm powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. All of a sudden, it became we. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And that's step one. And I know today that without the we, I don't have a chance, man. 7 days later, he sent me home. He gave me my prescription. Most valuable thing anybody's ever given me in my life. He gave me a meeting scheduled, Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, when you get home, I want you to do two things. You go to a meeting. When you get to the meeting, you get a sponsor. And I got home. I didn't know what to do. I told y'all what I do when I don't know what to do. I called my mama. I said, Ma, I got to go to an AA meeting. She said, well, I'll come get you. She said, my mom knows all about Alcoholics Anonymous. She went to meetings with my daddy in the 40s and the 50s. There's been a big book in my house as long as I can remember. She dropped me on your doorstep. It was July 4th, 1982. She left me with this advice I want to share with you. She said, I'm not coming back to get you. You go to the front table. You tell the people at the front table you're new. You don't have a car. You don't have a driver's license. You need a ride home. And you stay away from the women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I paid attention to just about half. But I got a sponsor that night. He gave me stuff to do that night. Simple stuff to do. His wife was a chairperson. She handed me the traditions, asked me if I'd read. I backed up. I said, yeah, I don't know, honey. You know, they just took the straps off me. You might find you might want to find someone else to do that. And he just looked at me. You know how they look at you. He said, here's your first lesson in AA, Tim. You never say no to Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter what the request is, the answer is yes. That's all you're going to need to know about that. Then he said, if you had a coffee cup, you'd throw it away. If you sat in a chair, you put it away. If you used an ashtray, now this is a long time ago when AA was civilized. Say, you empty it. He said, I want you to read one page of the big book every day. Don't turn that page until tomorrow. Read that page as many times that day as you want to or think you need to. Do not turn the page until tomorrow. And just maybe, in 164 days, you might know something about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, if you're not praying, this is how you start. You're going to take three words your mother taught you when you were a little boy. You're going to get up in the morning and kneel down. And you'll say, please. You're going to get up and go about your day, and at the end of that day, you'll kneel back down. And you'll say, thank you. Please and thank you. My mama did teach me those words when I was a little boy. Do you know what she called them? The magic words. What's the magic word, Jimmy? I had no idea how much magic those words held until I came here to you and you showed me how to use them. And my sponsor asked me that question. I'm a firm believer in this. I don't know about y'all. We tell new people stupid stuff. You know, I don't know why we do it. We just do it. You know, we're going to tell you stuff like there's no such thing as a stupid question. And then we're going to ask you two or three stupid questions. It's just how it works. I don't know why it works, but that's how it works. And my sponsor asked me that question. I don't know if your sponsor asked you. He said, do you want what I have? I said, well, I don't know what you got. You know, well, do I want what you have? My sponsor had a brand new Tornado. He wore a Rolex watch. His wife was a stewardess. She had the prettiest green eyes I ever saw in my life. Do I want what you got? What page is that on, buddy? You know, after. See, I didn't know what he was trying to give me. Because when I got here, I didn't want what you had. I only knew one thing for sure when I got here. And that's that I didn't want what I had. That I knew for sure. And God loved me so much, he put people like you in my path to show me another way. Do you know when I knew I had what you wanted me to have the first time? You know what I knew for sure? First time I gave it away. Then I understood. All you wanted for me were those promises to come true. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity left as soon as I gave it away. I came to believe by watching that if I did what you did, my life could be like yours. And that's what I did. I knelt down with my sponsor and I said a third-step prayer. I wasn't crazy about the third-step prayer, or the third step, for that matter. I don't know what y'all thought first time you saw it. First time I looked at it, I said, what if it works? Then what? I'm going back and forth with my sponsor about this. You know, so I said, okay, here's the deal. We're going to kneel down. He said, right. I said, I'm going to turn my will and my life over to your God. He said, that's right. I said, then what? He said, well, we don't know. I said, you don't know? What do you mean you don't know? I said, you got to give me something. And he did. If you got one, you can understand the third step, too. I always have one. It's a penny. This is a special penny. This one's from 1918. It's the year my mama was born. And if you look at the back of the penny, you're going to see 1 cent. But do you know what happens as soon as you turn it over? On the front of the penny, it says, "In God, we trust." And that's the third step. That step's not about God's will. It's about mine. Am I willing today to trust God? I can tell you I am. And once you can do that, there's another word on the front of that penny, and that word's liberty. And that's the freedom you can have just by trusting God a day at a time. I started on that fourth step, but that's not one you want to rush right into. But y'all know that, right? No, you really got to take your time with that because you got to read all them books. We ain't got nothing in Alcoholics Anonymous, pal. We got books. We got blue books, blue and blue books, little blue books, little black books, little green books, little red books. We got lists. We got guides. We even got experts in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And if you don't read every one of those books, talk to every old timer in the world, you're going to mess up the fourth step, aren't you? There's only one way to do the fourth step wrong. Don't do it. That's the only way you can do the fourth step wrong is don't do it. I read all those books. I talked to every old timer in Cleveland. I'm sober 28 years, and I'm still not 100% sure what Mr. Jones's problem really is. I'm sitting at home one night, the phone rang. It's my sponsor. He said, "How's that fourth step coming?" I said, "Oh, it's coming right along." And he gave me something, a little information. You don't want to give your new guy too much information. He said, "Oh, it's going to get done in God's time," he said. And you know, that's exactly what I was thinking about that fourth step getting done, too. And I hung the phone up. About 5 minutes later, my phone rang. It's my sponsor. He said, "How's that fourth step coming, Tim?" I got something now, right? I got information. Give it right back to him. I said, "It's going to get done in God's time." And he said, "Well, that's a good thing, because God's time's tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. That's just the kind of guy he was. He's always helping. He'd sit behind you at meetings. You know, they'd say, "We need coffee help next month." He'd raise my hand. "Hey, Tim will do it." Tim still does it. I'm the donut guy at my home group. I bring the donuts. I always get the same kind. If I'm the donut guy, I get to get what I want. I always get the same kind, because you know how drunks are. I don't want nobody up there after the meeting scratching their head trying to make a decision. Get a donut and move on. I did a fourth and a fifth step. I had to become entirely ready for those things to go away. That's to let go. And then I had to go to step seven. And that's to let God. I couldn't do it by myself. I had to humbly ask on a power greater than myself for help for those character defects to leave. And the way they're going to leave is if I go on to step eight. And my sponsor's on the way over. We're going to do this 8 and 9 deal. And I'm looking at my eighth step. And I'm looking at this guy over here, you know. I did that to him. I don't dispute it. I did it. But you know, he did this to me. Man, I scratched him off the list. That's a push. Oh, no, we're even. So I'm steady scratching people off my list, waiting for my sponsor to come over. By the time he gets there, there's no one on my list but my mama. I just can't find a reason to take Mama off the list. He said, "Tim, you got to learn to forgive. This step's not about them. This step is about you. And you have to learn to forgive everybody that ever wronged you. Once you can do that, then and only then, will you have the right to ask anybody else for any kind of forgiveness." I became ready. I forgave, and I went out and I made direct amends to the people I've wronged. And before I was halfway through, those promises started coming true. just like the book says. I have a great life today. I have that Porsche in the driveway today. Oh, I keep it disguised as a Toyota. That... That's just so no one will steal it. Maybe you'll see it someday and you'll think, well, that's no Porsche. That's a Toyota. But you got to remember this. There's only one person in this room tonight. Only one. That's looking out of your eyes. And that is the only person that's ever going to be responsible for what you see. You can see good or you can see bad. But you're the one looking. So when I get home, I'm going to get inside my car. Alcoholics Anonymous is an inside job. I spent my whole life believing if I could make the outside look good enough, that the inside would feel better. Until I came here and you showed me how to work from the inside out. And I'm going to get inside my car. And I'm not going to see Toyota. I'm going to see Porsche. 911. It's triple black with a moonroof. It's got a Bose CD system in it with a 12-disc changer. And I'm going to hit those power windows. And I'll drive to work on Monday to my job. You know the job I didn't used to have when I was drinking? And there's I'm going to see my friends. Those would be the friends I didn't used to have when I was drinking. I don't know who has your message. Do you? Are you waiting for somebody with 60 or 70 years of sobriety? Because maybe, just maybe, the messenger God sent for you today isn't even going to get sober for 60 or 70 more minutes. I know this. That if there's somebody talking and I can hear them, God wants me to listen. I got a message on the first step about 18 years ago. I was invited to speak in Indiana. My wife couldn't go with me that weekend, so I took a new guy with me. I didn't want to take my car because I didn't think my car would make it to Indiana. So I took my wife's car. She was driving a Honda Civic back then. And you know, in a Honda Civic, what do you get in a Honda Civic? 300-400 miles to a gallon in a Honda Civic, right? No, really, you drive a Honda Civic pretty much from now on. Never had to book no gas in a Honda Civic. Me and my new guy headed for Valparaiso, Indiana. We went underneath the exit, said my exit was about 5 exits away. And I looked down, and the gas case said empty. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, empty like in a real car, huh? But empty in a Honda Civic, you got to have 100 miles left, right? There's only 50 in Indiana. I'm not worried. I never give it another thought. Until we went under a sign that said my exit was 2 miles. As soon as I went underneath that sign, I ran out of gas. If you got a Honda Civic and it says empty, oh, they're dead serious about that. That's that's exactly what they mean. Now, I coasted for another mile. And I pulled over to the side of the road. And there I was, in the middle of Indiana, out of gas. Got a new guy sitting next to me. You know, I don't even want to turn to look at him. I just spent the better part of about 4.5 hours telling him all about responsibility and stuff like that. But I had to do something, right? I couldn't sit in Indiana the rest of my life. So I turned and I looked. He just grinned. You know how they are. They'll stay sober a long time waiting for you to do something wrong. He looked over at me and he said, "We're powerless, ain't we?" I said, "Yeah, you bet we are." I said, "What do you think we ought to do about it?" He said, "I think we better admit it." I said, "Yeah, because I can sit here the rest of my life going, vroom, 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 vroom. If I never admit there's a problem, I'm never going to get anywhere." I don't know who has your message today. Are you listening? I take one word out of the last three steps, and that's how I live my life. Continue. Improve. And practice. Now, each one of those words is an action word. If you want something, you've got to do something. My book says half measures avail me nothing. It doesn't say half measures avail me half. It says nothing. I don't know about you. I've had much, much more nothing in my life than I want. I don't want any more nothing. I want everything. I want everything my God wants me to have. And do you know, I don't even know what that is. But if He wants it for me, I want it too. There's a difference in my life today I'm going to share with you. I go to the prisons and I talk to the guys in the penitentiaries. I didn't go for a long time. I got sick. I had hepatitis C. Went through interferon treatment for it, and I was sure that was going to kill me. Just zapped every bit of energy I had. It took a bunch of my hair, and I lost about 35 pounds. It was horrible. So I didn't go for a long time. And then I had other responsibilities, and then they changed the rules in Ohio. If you want to go into a penitentiary in Ohio, you got to fill out an application. I never had to fill an application out. To get into a penitentiary. I was always pre-approved when I got there. Twenty-some years ago, I was out western Ohio talking at a joint out there, and I gave a little talk. And a guy came up to me after the meeting. He said, can I call you? And I said, well, yeah, sure, you can call me. You see, I forgot. You want to call somebody from the penitentiary, you got to call collect. But I'll accept a collect phone call in my life today. I want to tell you why. Because on April 10th, 1989... I went to a meeting. There was a young lady speaking at the meeting that night. And I don't know what your sponsor told you. My sponsor had these little sayings he used to throw at me all the time. My sponsor told me this a lot. He said, Tim, if you go to a meeting and you hear something you like, take it home. Took you a while, Jersey girl, didn't it? And on October 16th, 1993, we got married. I married a young lady in the Fellowship of the Alcoholics Anonymous. Her name's Mary. And if you're here Sunday morning, you'll listen to her talk. I married a very intelligent woman in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, a very educated woman. My wife just loved school. Been in school as long as you can go to school. I didn't care much for school. Couldn't wait to get out. As a matter of fact, I didn't wait to get out of school. But my wife, she just educated. She got more letters after her name than I got in my name. She got a BA. She got an MA. She got an MACT. She was ABD. Then she got a PhD. And then she got my personal favorite. That's a J-O-B. One of my guys asked me once, he said, doesn't that intimidate you? That your wife's so intelligent, your wife's so educated, doesn't that intimidate you? I had to stop and think about it for a minute. Because I never had before. And I said, no. No, doesn't intimidate me at all. Makes me proud as hell. I'm proud as hell of my wife's accomplishments. Because 22 years ago, she came through that door. And she didn't have any letters after her name. But because of a God of her understanding and a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, the women in her home group that told her, once you come through that door, if you're willing to do the work, you can be anything you want to be. She trusted God, she worked hard, and she accomplished. I can't be intimidated by that, only proud. I'm so proud I got new license plates. You know those vanity plates? Don't you hate those things? They got those in Georgia, right? Oh, yeah. I think they're stupid. But I got some. You know what my license plates say? They say, PhD, GED. I got letters after my name, too. We had an AA wedding. It started with the Serenity Prayer and it ended with the Lord's Prayer. Had a reading from the 12 and 12 in between. I was reminded on that day of the chance I got to make a collect phone call in 1975. And they walked me into the bullpen. They said I could call anywhere in the world I wanted to call, and I had this much time to do it, but I had to do it collect. And I stood there and dialed. And I dialed. And I dialed until I had no more time left. And I couldn't find one person on this earth, not one, that would accept a collect phone call from me at that time in my life. Not one. We invited 320 people to that wedding. You know how many came? About 350. Do you see the difference? The difference from then to now. That's the difference in my life, but there's a difference in me. About 9 years ago, I had to become my stepfather's caregiver. He had Alzheimer's. It's a terrible thing to watch. And Al-Anon once told me it's a lot like what they see as they watch us deteriorate in front of them and they feel the hopelessness and helplessness that they feel. And there weren't two people on earth that hated each other more than me and my stepfather. My mother just couldn't do it all by herself. So I helped for a while, and then we had to find another place for him. He just got too sick and too dangerous to keep him at home. So we found a real nice place for him out in Sandusky, Ohio, about an hour from our house. And we took him out there, and they treated him real well. And on the weekends, we'd go spend the weekends visiting my stepfather, me and my mom. After about a year, he passed away. That left me with an 82-year-old mother at home. And I had to start taking care of my mom. And mom did okay for a long time. She had a couple of strokes. She broke her hip a couple of times. But she did okay. And she didn't want to go in any kind of a home. And we had that talk. I said, Mom, look. I said, the first few years of my life, you fed me. You took care of me. You changed my diapers. If I have to do that for you, the last few years of your life, I would be more than happy to do that. And she looked at me and she said, as only a mother could say, the first few years of your life. The first 30 years of your life. I was in a position, because of my business partners, an understanding wife and a loving God, that mom didn't have to go into a home. I had a woman who took care of her during the day. And after work, I'd come over and I'd make her dinner. I'd get her cleaned up and put her pajamas on and get her into bed, set all the TV channels for her. And she was fine. On the weekends, I was there all weekend. And I made a number of meals for her and write her checks, and we'd just catch up. I hadn't been allowed in her house. I was sober 16 and a half years before I was permitted back into their home. And we'd catch up, and that's what I did on weekends. Do you know what I like to do on weekends? I like to play golf. I wasn't able for a long time. I got real sick, and I just didn't have the opportunity for an awful long time to play. A lot of my friends still played. And one of them called me one day and he says, Tim, we got an opening in the foursome on Sunday morning. Would you like to join us? And I said, boy, you know, I'd love to join you on Sunday morning, but I won't be able to. I'll be with my mom Sunday morning. And he said this. He said, do you have to be with your mom on Sunday morning? I said, no. No, I don't have to be with my mom on Sunday morning. I get to be with my mom. I get to be there on Sunday morning. I want to share something with you my mother told me. I think it's the most valuable thing anybody's ever said. It's certainly the most valuable thing she's ever said. I'd go over there in the evenings, and it was time for me to go to a meeting. I'd go in the back. I'd get her ready and put her pajamas on and put her to bed. Give her a kiss on the forehead. I say, Mom, I'm going to a meeting. I love you. And when we tell somebody we love them, wouldn't we like them to say this? I love you too. Huh? Wouldn't we like to hear that? One particular night I went back. I said, Mom, I'm going to the meeting. I gave her a kiss on the forehead and I said, I love you. And she didn't say, I love you too. She said something much, much more important. She said, I know you do. I know you do. People should know we love them long, long before we have to tell them. Is there somebody in your life every once in a while that goes through your mind? You know, I should call them. I should see how they're doing. Quit thinking about it and do it. It's awful hard to make amends at a funeral. On June 1st, 2001, I was kneeling next to my mother's bed, and I was holding her hand. And at 4:45 on that day, the angels came. They took her hand from mine, and they put it in God's. And I was able to do something on that day you taught me, and I'll never be grateful enough. You taught me to let go and to let God. We got a lot of purposes in Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we? We got a singleness purpose. We got a primary purpose. My favorite has always been our real purpose. And that is to fit myself to become of maximum use to my God and to those about me. Not just here. Everywhere. Remember, what you do today between the Serenity Prayer and the Lord's Prayer isn't as important as what you're doing today between the Lord's Prayer and the Serenity Prayer. Thanks so much for having me tonight.